Ceris Matthews first came to prominence in the 1990s, of course, as the singer with Welsh rockers Catatonia. You'll recall hits like Road Rage and Mulder and Scully, and all sung in a great Welsh brogue. So since Catatonia split, she's pursued a solo career. She's been on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. She's become an acclaimed broadcaster, a children's author. I could go on. But now she's venturing into the world of international cuisine, no less, with her first cookbook, which is called Where the Wild Cooks Go. Ceris Matthews, you're very welcome.
Is it still morning? No, it's good afternoon.
It's afternoon here where I am. So, Ceris, Where the Wild Cook Goes, I suppose, is a little bit more than a cookbook, isn't it?
It's quite different for a cookbook, actually, because it's not just recipes. It's got poetry in it, and it's got a ton of food history. And a lot of it will surprise people, I think, and a lot of things to make you smile as well.
I suppose what it's about, really, the places you travelled and getting the texture of those places, and it's through a bit of food, it can be a bit of poetry, a bit of music, a bit of folklore, that kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, totally that. So it's flexitarian, so you can cook them with meat or no meat for the most part anyway. Like, there's Welsh cakes in there, in my own culture, which is Wales, obviously. So you can do Welsh cakes either way, normal way or vegan way. And in Scotland, you can do cooked haggis, or you can do vegan haggis. So there's lots and lots of options, because I'm all for sort of like sustainable eating as well. But yeah, the most fun was collecting together all these things that make you smile. I used to keep a book on tour, and it's a lot of the stuff was in that book. Like in the Irish chapter, it's things like Jonathan Swift. It would have been a brave man that ate the first oyster, and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And actually, of course, being Irish, I went straight to the Irish section. And it turns out you have quite a close relationship to Ireland, don't you?
Well, I grew up about 50 miles away from the coast, the east coast of Ireland, because I grew up in a place called Treveen, which is, you can see the ferry crossing from Fishguard to Rosslare. And I used to collect mussels from the sea there. And in fact, the radio that we picked up all the time was the Gaelic radio. So yeah, I always felt like I was closer to Ireland than certainly, and I was, you know, physically and literally closer to Ireland than England.
And you say in the book as well, you fell in love over six oysters and a pint of Guinness in Davy Burns.
Yeah, I totally did. In fact, I got proposed to in the National Concert Hall as well in Dublin. Yeah, my husband's born in Donegal, so I love Ireland. We go there a lot, and we're coming back for a concert with the cookbook. We're coming to Dublin, so I'm really excited. It's like a bit of singing, a bit of poetry reading, a lot of stories and chat and food history, and some demonstrations. So I'm doing, there's cocktails in the book as well. One of them's in the Irish chapter. It's a cocktail given to me by Ian Brown from the Stone Roses.
And what is it? Tell us.
It's called Zest by Chocolate. I've got a Guinness fondant chocolate recipe in there as well, but this one is delicious. It's good if you don't like Christmas shopping, It's good for a winter warmer. So it's basically a shot of Tia Maria, a shot of vodka, and then you fill half pint glass up with Guinness. And it's the chocolatiest drink you'll ever imagine.
Okay, Death by Chocolate maybe, but I've a funny feeling it's not going to be the chocolate that would kill Ian Brown in the end. Come here, you also... You have Irish phrases in the book, a bit of Gaelic, as people call it. Do you have a few phrases of Irish yourself?
Only thank you.
Yeah? Do you go it?
I bore people to death when I'm over there, because because obviously I love languages, and I'm going, oh, what's this? Oh, is that similar to this, and this, that, and the other in Welsh, and stuff like that, and they're like, oh, God, can you just drink your drink, and let's talk about something else, you know?
Yeah, so you have, Diagwit is in the book, that's thank you, and you helpfully say, rhymes with twit.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct, and then you have slán lat. Which is goodbye, and you say rhymes with cat, so it's foolproof, really.
Well, I like to do
Diagwit means Diagwit means hello. I'm not thinking straight enough. Diagwit means hello, and show that I know what I'm talking about. In return, you would say Dia Smurgwit, and when you want to say goodbye, you would say slán. So I just let me get my Irish credentials back there. So, Ceris, what do you mean by the term wild cooks?
Well, for a number of reasons. Wild in terms of the type of recipes that I like to cook, and they're usually really fast, really straightforward, really delicious, sustainable, and good for the planet as well, and the pocket. So wild in terms of not being too shishy, none of those kind of foam making, too many sections, too many strange ingredients. They're really straightforward. They're for everyday cooking. So they're recipes inspired by our mums and grandmas and our sort of ancestors down the line. They're definitely of the home, the type of recipes that bring memories and identity and love and the idea of belonging, you know. So that's one wild element of it. So, and then the second one is that I love going out foraging. So there's a lot of talk, especially in the Welsh chapter, about the things that are edible that you can go, even if you live in the city. Nettle soup's in there. There's a hedgerow salad. You can go to the garage and get, you know, one of those bunches of chrysanthemums. You can actually use the petals to dress your salad, and you can eat them as well. So it's just reminding us, in a way, of the things that my grandfather taught me of what's edible, the linden trees when they're young, that grassy, you know, the goose grass, the sticky willy stuff that you throw up people's backs. Mm-hmm. If you get the young stems of that, you can wilt that in butter, just like you do with spinach. So it's just, you know, and mentioned hazelnuts, and all the sort of regular common things that are sorrel that are edible.
Yeah.
So that's another wild element. And then the third wild element is a discussion, I guess, of cooking outside. So you don't have to limit yourself to cooking on a charcoal, on what we term barbecue. But if you get a griddle, like a Welsh big stone or something, and put it on top of your grill, instead of spending like £2,000-3,000 on one of these fancy, you know, you can get the Green Egg Company are making these fancy copper sculptures that you can cook on with a big iron griddle on top. You can just get an old, in the antique place they have loads of them, the old griddles, put them on top of your barbecue, and there you're good to cook cherry tomatoes, garlic, broccoli, all those little bits and pieces that you can't normally cook on a grill very well.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't go out foraging and I didn't cook outside, but I did think it is my kind of cooking. Like, it is kind of food that you could throw together in a kind of a frenzy, isn't it? Rather than having to sit around for ages, you know, over worried about technique. I made a shakshuka and, yeah, you know, 10
yeah,
minutes
like to
of throwing
with a
stuff
bottle
together.
Of wine on the go.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
You know, and music. Oh, that's what I should mention. Each one of the chapters, and it goes from American South all the way east, and it ends in Japan. There's 15 countries, Mexico, Jamaica, so forth. Each one of those countries have made a playlist, and that's live now on Spotify. So if you're in a kitchen, look for the playlist, Keras playlist on Spotify, and you can cook to that country, to the music from that country.
I thought we'd give people one recipe, Keras, right? So you have a recipe for melon with sherry. Just give us the technique there.
Yeah, because some of these recipes are really simple ideas that I just picked up. I lived in Spain when I was 18, and this is when I picked up it. It's totally authentic. But if you're time poor and you just want to have fun and you know, have people smile, this is a great one. So you buy little tiny melons, cantaloupes, cut them in half, scoop out the seeds, and fill the hole with either port or sherry, and you give a half to each of your dinner guests.
And bang, and it's done.
Totally authentic.
And I noticed there's a section in the book for recipes from the American South. You have no section for the American North. You lived in the American South for a while, didn't you?
I certainly did. And, you know, as in every country, I mean, this is a thing with recipes. It's not rocket science. And it's, you know, every family will have different recipes for the same named dish. And every country will have different regions. It goes without saying that. But I lived in the American South for almost 6 years, and I fell in love with the people and the cuisine, particularly around the New Orleans and Louisiana areas, and particularly with soul food, which is really an example of food made out of the tough lives of the slaves there, because they were given the poor cuts. But you end with things like grits, which is like polenta in a way, and that's a really easy change from mashed potatoes or pasta, for example, and you can make a poached egg with that. You can make it with mushrooms. If you eat fish, you can put some prawns in there, add chilies, whatever you fancy. It's super easy and versatile. What else have I got in there? Oh, I've got cornbread with jalapenos. I can't remember what's in them all, actually, to be honest. There's loads of stuff there.
Yeah, I suppose the American South is testament to the fact that the best food really does come out of poverty often, doesn't it?
Well, you know what? I don't think thrift is a bad word. And with today's, you know, need for awareness in terms of food waste, the more knowledge we have as to, and the more options we have as to how to cook those common things that we have in our cupboards and fridges, then the better the planet will be. So I love soups. There's so many recipes in there. For instance, there's cowl, the Welsh cowl in there. And you can cook that with the lamb, or you can cook it vegetarian or even vegan ways. And there's also store cupboard soup in there. There's store cupboard curry in there. There's red soups and green soups, because people listening now that are keen cooks, or, you know, are capable cooks in terms of what they've learnt from the wise nuggets that have trickled down the centuries, will know that it's very, very straightforward to cook a delicious soup with what you've got left in the cupboard. And then you can make dumplings as well, like fluffy cloud ones, not hard nuggety ones that I see on these sort of chef shows sometimes, where they're like golf balls. Mine are like big fluffy cloud ones, like my mom taught me.
So did your mom teach you how to cook? Do you grow up in a household where food was important?
My mum is I've had permission from her to tell everyone this, but she was a rubbish cook, to be honest, when we were growing up. She only ate chicken and chips, and she only cooked Findus crispy pancakes. And so that was one of the reasons why I started taking an interest in the natural
world. There was nothing wrong with Findus crispy pancakes. They were a great treat when you were sick of home-cooked food, but hot in the middle, weren't they?
But if you only eat them, then you're limiting your mineral and vitamin intake, aren't you?
Okay.
Start to look like them. So, yes, but she did brilliantly, because, you know, I think it was, I write about it in the book, actually, in the 80s when all these sort of cheap flights came into the continent and we started travelling a bit more outside of Nice, South Wales, then we started taking a taste for different things, and she started cooking brilliantly, and she's an ace cook now, and she's quite explorative as well. So she's taught me how to cook, for instance, in the Indian chapter. We've got coriander chutneys in there, chapatis in there, dals in there, and saag paneer. And she also taught me that, and what's fascinating as well about the book is what we have not indifferent to different. I mean, there's the celebration of the differences in our cultures, but also the similarities. So if you take paneer, which is the Indian cheese, we made that, and we called it cuckoo's cheese or farmer's cheese in Wales, and the Mexicans do it and they call it queso fresco, and all it is heated up milk separated with an acid like vinegar or lemon or lime juice, and you can do it instantly. And my kids love doing it because they get an old t-shirt and, you know, separate the solids out in a t-shirt, and I think that's hilarious.
In this section on China, you have a little bit of Confucianism in there.
And I love Confucius.
Yeah, and Confucius had, he was a lot about dining and how you behaved in situations and everything. He said, you have a great line in there, you can drink as much wine as you want, but you must not get drunk. So thanks, Confucius. But you have a quote from him as well about everybody having two lives. And I guess you, in a way, you probably had more than two lives, but you did have that kind of rock and roll life, didn't you?
I did. The brilliant quote from Confucius is that we've all got two lives. The second begins once we realise we've only got one life. But he's also got another one. It's no problem going slow as long as you don't stop.
Yeah. You talk in the book about coming home, being dropped off from the tour bus and going to the local Italian cafe, restaurant, and that would get you back to normality. Because I think you ultimately found the touring and the rock and roll lifestyle, you developed some bad habits around it, didn't you?
I did. You know, I was young. We had a strange sort of life, a daily sort of schedule, you know. It was night living and night working, and I'm more of a morning person, and it's a lot of attention and it's not very grounded. So, you know, it's the old cliche, but you know what, that's 20 years ago now, and I it's made me appreciate life and this wonderful chance we have been given to live to the utmost that we can, you know, and you know, celebrate every single day on this planet. It really has.
Yeah.
And I adore the fascinating things and the cultures and the characters that we've got in the book. I actually talk quite a lot about Maiwin Sakat. Do you know who that is?
No.
That's St. Patrick.
Okay. Of course, one of your own, wasn't he?
Well, that's what's surprising, you know. You think about these things, like, do you know where a kiwi fruit is from?
Say again?
A kiwi fruit. Do you know where that is from?
A kiwi fruit, I'm imagining, is from New Zealand?
It's from China originally. It was called the Chinese gooseberry, and it was the farmers in New Zealand that rebranded it to sell it more, to sell it good. So there's loads of surprises, like chilies are not indigenous to India, tomatoes not indigenous to Italy, schnitzels are probably from Italy, croissants are not from France, and St. George never slayed a dragon, and he never probably even set foot in England. So there's all these things that make you kind of smile and rethink world history.
And Kerris, it is a lovely book and absolutely full of those great little nuggets and everything. A life-affirming book, I think. It's called Where the Wild Cooks Go by Kerris Matthews. Kerris Matthews, thanks very much. And you know what? We'll just play out with a tiny snatch of music. You mentioned in the Irish section, A Pair of Brown Eyes by the Pogues. So let's take a little bit of that.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.